Hi, hello, and welcome to another episode of The Dunker Spot. We are part of 342 Productions. I am your host, Nikias Duncan, and joining me as always is my co-host, Steve Jones Jr. Steve, how are you doing, sir?
Feeling good, feeling great. Happy to be here, excited to be here. Thank you, Dunkers, for once again embracing your bounce. Dunker Nation, let's ride. Nikias, time to hoop it up. It's a great day for white tees and basketball fans. It's a bad day for walking fossils.
That it is. Let me tell you, I am in shambles for what I've witnessed over the past, I don't even know, 18 hours or whatever the case may be at this point. Heat Bucks was a wild one. I got caught up on Kings Warriors from yesterday. We got the Brittany Griner presser. That was dope to see. I just wasn't able to sleep after Heat Bucks. The season finale of Bel Air had me in shambles. I am all over the place as we record early on a Thursday afternoon. We have not gotten Celtics Hawks yet. But man, what a stretch of time it's been. Fun playoff hoops indeed. We got some series to end. We have a couple of series in tow for the second round already. We have the Denver Nuggets facing off with the Phoenix Suns. We have the Miami Heat taking on the New York Knicks. Let's start out west with the Nuggets and the Suns. Season series was tied at 2-2, but the fun part about that, Steve, as you get ready to prep, as we prep for this one, it's hard to take much of anything from them. First two games, the Nuggets won, but both came before the Kevin Durant trade. Devin Booker played, I think, 4 or 5 minutes on the Christmas matchup, and then him and Chris Paul weren't available in the second matchup. Next two games, we did get the KD unit with Phoenix. So naturally, four of Denver's five starters were out in the first matchup late in March, and then no starters played in the April matchup. So we are kind of coming in with a blank slate in regard to what these two teams have looked like against each other this year. Go ahead.
It's a very annoying part if you're trying to jog your brain, but it's also kind of fun. You now let the playoffs speak for themselves, the matchups speak for themselves, the questions pop up in your head. You're trying to figure out what each team is going to do. I'm thinking, hey, was Denver just saying, absolutely not, we're not playing anyone against y'all these two times? DeAndre Jordan, go play drop. Let's see what it looks like. Is that going to end up just being a brilliant move?
Shoot, it just might, man. It just might. Like, I was just trying to find something I can glean from. Like, okay, let me see. Like, head again to prep. Like, okay, let me see what the Devin Booker possessions look like. Since even though they didn't have Kevin Durant, he's going to be very important to Phoenix's offense, obviously. How does Denver defend him? And it's just, what do we take from the regular season series? I don't know what to do. And so, zooming out, coming in with this kind of blank slate on this series, my first question became, how is Denver planning to match up with Phoenix? Not even just before getting into the schemes, I do have dropper at the level questions and stuff like that. But on a fundamental level, who's defending who in this series? Are we seeing Jamal Murray on Chris Paul? Are we going to see some cross matching where we get maybe an MPJ on Chris Paul in light of how the Clippers treated Chris Paul off the ball in the first round series? Like, we're cool with helping off of him. We don't trust that he's going to shoot quick enough or shoot at all. We can get back out there. We don't know if he's going to be an active off-ball mover. So maybe depending on where he's spaced, you can use MPJ and keep him closer to the rim. Is that something that Denver wants to look into? I my mind just went all over the place thinking about potential matchups. That's kind of where I started.
So you went full matchup man on me.
I did indeed. Much to your chagrin.
Let's go in a nutshell. I think I understand the MPJ on Chris Paul point. My only counter would be, I don't love MPJ as a screen navigator. So I don't love him having to navigate with Jokic in whatever coverage he's going to be in. And then what's the help behind it? So I would imagine Aaron Gordon, KCP, they're going to be attached to Kevin Durant, Devin Booker. I don't know who's on who, but I think that'll happen. I imagine they use MPJ against the fifth and say, hey, man, you help.
Okay.
You just do your job. And then I think Jamal Murray on Chris Paul. That'd be my first guesstimate.
That makes sense. And like, the fifth is interesting in this regard, because again, you have the MPJ helping option there. If you were to put him on, if it's Torrey Craig still starting, or if it is Josh Okogie in the starting lineup, like, that makes sense. But then my mind then goes to Jokic. It's like, huh, do you just want to put him on eight and say, hey, you just have to nail this? He's a big man. You're a big man. Win your matchup defensively as well. Or do you put him on one of the, on Craig or Kobe, whichever starts, and try to hide him in that way? Or if Phoenix wants to use one of those guys as the primary screener, you kind of deal with that.
I don't love that because they're just going to put him in pick and roll anyways, if they want to. Like, I mean, after a series of Zubac, and like they tried that, and Torrey Craig was like, sure, I'll screen. And then it's like, do you really want to put, you know, do you want to put MPJ as a target and pick and roll if he's guarding Ayton? And I just, I think they keep it vanilla to start.
Okay. Understandable. So that's where I went immediately. What kind of stood out to you, or what were your primary questions heading into this one?
Buddy, I had primary, secondary, tertiary. What's the one for four? I got all the questions for you on this one. I am very intrigued to see how this plays out. My initial thought, first thought, as soon as this series happened, what is Denver going to do on defense? Mm-hmm. That seems a little patently unfair, but stick with me. Pick and rolls, handoffs, massive part of what Phoenix does. What does Denver do? Their best coverage is at the level. Some version of two on the ball. We saw them mix coverage against Minnesota. How do they want to handle Phoenix to start? Do they go with drop and try and be conservative? How long can they live with that drop if they start that way? Do they go to two on the ball and trust that their rotations and weak side is going to be there? If they do, what does that open up for the Phoenix Suns playbook? Can they mix switches in? Is the help off the fifth person going to be the deciding factor on whatever coverage they pick? I was lost there. And in my gut, there's a couple things I can't shake. Like for me, every year in the first round, there's a team that gets a tough series, a tough matchup, a tough problem to solve. They survive it. And then, oh, wait, we don't have to deal with that anymore. Let's go hoop.
Let's hoop it up.
The Suns are that team for me right now. To go from that unique challenge that the Clippers threw at them with all sorts of different coverages, trying to flip matchups. Denver can hit some notes defensively, but they can't hit the same ones. Mm-hmm. And so I'm very interested to see this Phoenix play more free. I can't shake the feeling. I feel like they will, and I think the playbook's going to open up for them. That's where I go. Because you have these scenarios. If you put two on the ball, now Phoenix can just manipulate. They can just manipulate. We go empty corner. We go the handoff action, Chicago action. I know you love it. We put Kevin Durant and Devin Booker on the same side and say, hey, bring your help in, buddy. we're skipping to one of them. So that's where I'm like, okay, can they handle that? And then my mind goes, well, I think they can mix it. And it's like, well, with Chris Paul, do we go drop? Do we say you are going to have to be the one who makes these shots consistently? Do they get wild and say, hey, Nikola, we know the switching isn't really your thing, but Chris Paul, go ahead and try it, man. Just switch a couple of them. What are they going to do? That's where my mind goes initially. And then it's also like, hey, the Suns are going to have to guard Denver. And I'm trying to wrap my head around what that looks like. Because the Clippers had offensive success against Phoenix in that series. Denver's a different machine execution-wise, movement-wise, cutting, handoffs, sets. The trick for me is, can the Suns handle Jokic? Can they be locked in on that movement, on those cuts? Can they deal with Jamal Murray? There isn't quite the same level of individual bucket getting that the Clippers presented, but there is the ability to generate quality shots. So does Phoenix's team defense kick in? Are they able to throw switches in to muck things up for Denver? Who are they comfortable switching? Like, do you want Ayton on the perimeter? Do you want to put KD on Jokic? Do you want to send help? Like, I'm very curious. I'm very, very curious. But back to my other point, even if Phoenix opens up the playbook, buddy, does this version of Phoenix know itself well enough to hit the right notes?
I was about to say, like, my kind of secondary question to that, because I had a similar thought, like, how much of the playbook are they ready to open up?
Because that was one of those things. Even in the closeout game against the Clippers, it was like, hey, Kevin Durant, fourth quarter, he's just standing there.
Menacingly.
he's still standing there. It felt like the Suns playbook featuring Kevin Durant. And it's like, I mean, you could just you give him a few more bars. You could use him as a screener, do something. It just it's a back and forth for me. But I do know Denver's rotations have to be locked in, and Phoenix is gonna have to up their defense. Both of those things are gonna be factual.
Absolutely. And just to bounce off of that, what I had in my notes as a question is, what's the spacer versus usage balance with Kevin Durant in this series? Because going back to that closeout game, I just found myself in a weird place with it. Because one, Devin Booker was just on a heater that entire series. And Kevin Durant, one of the best shooters that we've ever seen. There is logic behind, hey, not only does this guy have it cooking, we can make life easier for him if we just have Kevin Durant one pass away. And if you still want to send extra help to Devin Booker and the ball finds Kevin Durant with 8 seconds left on the clock, let's just say there are many worse options to save a possession than Kevin Durant in that case. So I got it. But I did feel like it got a little too much towards, hey, he's not doing anything. Because it's one thing for him to be spaced one pass away at the wing. It's another thing to have multiple possessions in a row where he's standing like 30 feet from the basket. And it's just like, okay, you can't reach that portion to where he's just chilling, even if Devin Booker's cooking like this. So I don't think they can afford to do that as much. But to your point about Denver's kind of scheme versatility, if they can lean into it, I do think this is going to end up being a very important Chris Paul series. Like how aggressive he's going to be. I feel like I'm echoing what I said in the first round, but it kind of holds true. Like I wouldn't be surprised if Denver sprinkles in a switch or two against Chris Paul. Now, am I giving Chris Paul 8 switches against Jokic, even this version of Chris Paul? No, I don't want to do that. I wouldn't do that. Can they do it in a pinch? That gets interesting to me, because if they can fit in enough drop and enough switching, and you kind of zoom out to what Phoenix's shot profile overall is, if it's going to be shot making for twos versus post-ups and cuts for twos, Denver doesn't have the horses that Phoenix has, but like they can hang in that kind of fight. If it just becomes a who could be more efficient inside the arc battle, it's going to look different. Phoenix has more avenues to just clear aside and say, hey, Book, you got it. KD, you got it. Chris Paul, you got the switch. You got it. But Jokic can score. And like so many people have cited what DeAndre Ayton was able to do against Jokic in that second round series a couple of years ago. And he did do a good job. That should not be removed. Also, you think about the spacing that Jokic had in that series because of who was missing and how he was able to get a little bit more help while also dealing and doing his solid job on Jokic himself. It's a little bit different this time around. And as we've kind of zoomed out from that series and some of the regular season matches he's had, like Jokic is, he's gotten some buckets against DeAndre Ayton. So it's going to be an important series for him too. But I guess my overarching thought is like, if this becomes a half court battle, I don't think it would be wise to just say, well, Phoenix has more self-creators. They win. They may still win. But I don't think it's going to be as cut and dry as that.
I think it's going to be interesting to see which team can generate quality looks consistently. And who can they generate them for? And Michael Porter Jr. and Jamal Murray can both go get buckets. Aaron Gordon can be used in fun different ways. It's interesting you bring up KD, and my mind is thinking, how many people do Denver feel comfortable guarding him one-on-one? Three?
1.5?
Like Aaron Gordon, and then
MPJ's from just a pure size slash contest perspective, sure.
But also.
But yeah, if you got, hey. We go on that elbow set. Cross screen at the elbow, and now MPJ got the devil. But like, that's even with that, right? The MPJ that was playing defense 2 years ago is not the MPJ playing defense right now. And the screen navigation from MPJ still isn't great, to be clear. But it is better than what it was. And so depending on what Phoenix runs for KD and how intentional they are about, we are taking this 8 possession pocket to attack this and attack him. I think MPJ may be able to hold up a little bit better than people anticipate. If I have to take the L on that, then I will. It's not the first time I've been wrong. But like, at least thinking through it, like, I think they can afford to give him that matchup sometimes. actually, that kind of leads into a question that I had for you. Who's more important to Denver's defense? Who needs to hold up more in this series? Jamal Murray or Michael Porter Jr.?
I mean, I think Jamal Murray because of the size.
Okay.
Michael Porter Jr., philosophically, yes, because you don't want to be in a scenario where he gets played off the floor. I don't think that happens. But I think because of some of the matchups, like if they want to go matchup hunting and just use KD as a screener and here's Jamal Murray, and it's either A, bucket, or B, double team, and now Phoenix can just play out of that, that's not great. And then if they just decide, hey, Devin Booker, you get that Jamal Murray matchup, you go to work. Like, you just don't want that to happen. Because now you have that plus whatever you do in pick and roll, plus them just able to make tough shots. So I think it's important for Murray to have his defensive shoes on. I also think it's important for Chris Paul to have his shoes on. Here's the tricky part, though. Does Denver have the ability to attack Chris Paul like that?
I think this very much becomes a Murray question. Honestly, I think they, even more so than the Clippers, I think they have a way to move Chris Paul around the chessboard a little bit. So I think if you can get him on Jamal Murray, like you can just run him through pick and rolls, or you can go through handoff actions, or even have Jamal Murray off the ball and run him through some stuff. You can get Chris Paul that way. If you put him on KCP, like Denver will run a stagger or two for him. He's not going to be featured more than Jokic or Murray, obviously, but you can do that. Like going back just, I guess, last couple of seasons with Phoenix and this, with Chris Paul facing Denver, like he's had some possessions on MPJ before. Like, okay, he's not going to have on ball usage. We can hide him here. So like you can just throw it to MPJ. If that's the case, make him shoot over the top. Still going to have some of the off ball stuff. MPJ is a very good cutter as well. And I also think, you know, going back to the Jamal Murray matchup, one of the fun things about this Denver half court offense is how often they use Jamal Murray as a screener. Like, they will just toss the ball into Jokic at the elbow. Why is Aaron Gordon spaced at the wing? Oh, wait, here comes Jamal Murray setting the back pick. What do you do with this? Are we switching this? Are we shading help anywhere? I don't know what to do. And so they move it around. They'll have that action at the wing. They'll go more flex in the corner. It may not be a pure Russell Westbrook has Chris Paul, he will drive. Norman Powell has Chris Paul, he will drive. But I think they have the ability to really move Chris Paul around and ding him in multiple ways. And that can get a little bit dicey if he's not able to hold up.
I got you. So I'll ask this question real quick. What's more important for Denver, their defense or their offense?
I think it's going to be the defense. Because I think, ultimately, I think they're going to have enough avenues to score against this Phoenix group. And so for me, it's more so, Can you bog Phoenix down, one? But at the very least, can you contribute to Phoenix bogging itself down with some of the, hey, Chris Paul is dribbling 40 feet from the basket. He's doing a lot of aggressive pointing and waving because he wants KD to go here. He wants Torrey Craig to space here. He wants Booker to move over here, et cetera, et cetera. And if you throw in enough drop one possession, a switch one possession, we're at the level one possession. Can you contribute to Phoenix being like, okay, I don't know which, we know we can attack these different things. We don't know which one to do. Now you're burning clock. Now it's late possession KD, late possession Devin Booker, and still quiet as kept. Devin Booker is like the rim pressure guy for them right now. And so if you're able to contain those well enough, Denver can get into some transition or some of the early offense against Phoenix. So I worry less about the offense as a whole. I think they have to be able to hold up enough defensively. If this is a Phoenix has a 118 offensive rating series, they have a shot. And they may very well just win the series. If it's Phoenix has a 129 offensive rating, we'll be talking about the series. We won't be talking about the series very long, if that's where it goes.
Okay. Okay, bars.
I don't want to say bars, but I just think the defense for Denver is going to be important. Like, I don't come into this thinking Denver's going to shut down Phoenix. I don't come into this thinking Phoenix is going to shut down Denver. I think you need to keep Phoenix at very good offense. Because if they hit elite or world beating, you're in trouble. And vice versa. I think this is going to be a very fun and high scoring series. A question I'll toss to you before we get into like X-Factors and stuff. With these two benches, who do you have a higher confidence level in heading into the series?
Um,
Yeah.
Y'all love bench talk. Why do y'all, can I ask a question?
Sure.
Why do y'all love bench talk in the playoffs when the rotation shortened?
Because they're shortening to what? That's the thing. Like, it's still going to get to 7 or 8. You want the line of versatility. You're going to want some guys to be spelled, et cetera. Like, I think it matters.
I would probably say I trust Denver's because I know who they're going to and what they're going to contribute. The tricky part for Phoenix is they have multiple options and they all can contribute, but are you going to hit the right buttons at the right time? And I could be wrong. Like, this could just be a Terrence Ross series. He may have more avenues to play. TJ Warren may have more avenues to play. And now Phoenix's bench looks different because it's a different matchup. We don't have to deal with some of the things Clippers presented.
Mm-hmm. Campaign should be back to that to that point. Go ahead.
So that could be that with Denver. Can you have the same impact with your non-Jokic lineups? I think that's something you got to consider. They worked very well against Minnesota because Minnesota had Cat in the five. They could switch and then get some stops. Do you have the same comfort level with those lineups if it's a KD or a Booker out there? Are you still going with the same switching? Are you still feeling good about that? So that's where I'm at. I just don't know. Like, for me with Denver, the problem is there's so many people that it just feels like they're not going to play. So now if the Christian Brown minutes are rough, or the Bruce Brown minutes are rough, or the Jeff Green minutes are rough, you can get to Jeff Green. Well, now do we throw another big out there? Now is Nekias Matt, DeAndre Jordan? Like, how many different avenues do we go on?
Ah, yes. The DeAndre Jordan, Bismack Biyombo battle shall feed families. Or make me very upset. One of those two things are likely. You can choose which one. I feel a little bit better about Denver's. I do wonder just generally how often Denver can go small, especially against these second units. Because you mentioned, you know, Jeff Green versus Cat, which sounds wild when you say it out loud. But just conceptually, we can switch these. Cat doesn't get the same openings on pops. He doesn't get the same openings with drives, et cetera, et cetera. Can you... Like, what is your comfort level switching or just throwing an extra body at KD? And then that kind of bleeds into, okay, who's out there with KD if he's the spearhead in the bench unit? Is there going to be a help point on the court to where Denver can afford to send extra attention to him and still feel relatively okay? That's going to be interesting to me. And you mentioned Christian Brown. I think it's going to be a very important series for him. He didn't make, like, my X-Factor list, but I think it's going to be very important for him. I think he's going to see a good amount of time on Devin Booker when he's out there. He's going to have to hold up defensively. Adds to the shooting and the cutting offensively, kind of keep things moving for Denver as well. To answer my own question, I guess I feel better about Denver's. But I think that might be the little game within the game that can help decide the series. Like, what does it look like when Murray goes to the bench and it's Jokic plus bench? What does it look like for Phoenix when Ayton's on the bench? Or if it's just KD plus or Booker plus? And whoever can hold serve the most in those minutes might have a little bit more of an advantage than we're thinking. On the X-Factor front, who are your X-Factors in this series?
Chris Paul, DeAndre Ayton for Phoenix. Chris Paul's defense has to hold up. He's going to have to contribute enough offensively so that he can be an initiator as well. I think DeAndre Ayton has to be able to produce offensively for Phoenix on the short roll. I think defensively he has to be able to hold up in the post. He may have to come up to the level. He may have to execute well and drop. He's going to have to be there. And so he can't have a bad series in this one. For Denver, it's the people they brought in to do the defense stuff. Aaron Gordon, Bruce Brown, and Kentavious Caldwell-Pope. This is why y'all are here. This particular series is why y'all are here. So we need everything you can bring to the table. You're going to have to knock down shots, drive closeouts, do your job defensively. If those guys are getting hit, it's going to be tough for Denver.
Okay. For me, I have Michael Porter Jr. on the Denver side. His shooting is going to be very important. The occasional ISO that he gets, if he gets a size mismatch, he's going to have to punish those. The rebound is going to be important for him. And biggest thing for me, the defense, where he's going to be deployed and how he's going to be deployed. If they are going to do some cross-matching for him, can he hold up? Can he navigate screens well enough? If he is in more of an off-ball role, can he nail the rotation? He's largely done so this season. Again, I will emphasize the MPJ that we saw in 2020 or 2021 is not the MPJ that we have seen in 2023 defensively. Not an elite guy by any stretch of the imagination, but in terms of doing your job and utilizing his size well, he's in the right direction on that. He has to nail it in this series, because if he doesn't, it gets troublesome very quickly. And then for Phoenix, I went Josh Okogie. Again, I'm not sure who gets the start between him or Torrey Craig entering the series. We'll see. This does feel more like an Okogie series. Like I would, if you're going to go with him, I think I would rather have him as the fifth to start, especially if you're going to put him on a Jamal Murray. Like, I just trust him against guards more so than Torrey Craig in that regard. I don't think there is a Craig matchup per se, unless you just want him on Aaron Gordon for the physicality, the way that Aaron Gordon's able to kind of lurk around a dunker spot and get some shots that way. But if Okogie's on the floor, can he generate extra opportunities with the offensive rebounding? Can he nail it as a cutter? And obviously, he's going to have to hold up defensively if he's going to get those minutes, if he's going to get those starts. Because if not, it does shift to Craig. And in terms of like the defense first personnel for Phoenix, it's not super extensive. It kind of has to be one of those two. And so since I feel like this is more of a matchup for Okogie, I think it's going to be very important for him to give productive minutes on both sides of the floor. Steve, what is your series prediction?
I think it's going to be a tough one. I think there are different paths for each team. I will glean and go Suns in six.
Okay. Well, this is boring. I also have the Suns in six. I think if this gets to seven, I think Denver wins it. But I go Suns in six. I think I have more questions about how Denver matches up than the inverse. And I think that's what kind of shifts it for me. Ultimately, though, I feel like this is going to be a great series. I think we're going to see a lot of points. I think we're going to see a lot of explosive offensive performances in this series. I'm very amped for this one. To the other series that we know so far, the Miami Heat, the New York Knicks.
Restore the feeling.
I don't know how many people anticipated this being the second round matchup that we were going to get. Just going off my prediction from the first round, I thought both of these teams were going to go down in the first round. But we're here. The Knicks won the season series 3-1 during the regular season. First and foremost, I am very impressed with what Jimmy Butler and the Miami Heat were able to do in round one against Milwaukee. And I'm going to talk about Milwaukee a little bit later in the pod. But the first round series we just got from Jimmy Butler was flat out historic. And sometimes just hilarious to watch with some of the shots that he made, some of the plays that he made. Pull-ups all over the place, drives all over the place. Crucial time, the passing was there, the defense switching on to Giannis when necessary. He's been incredible. I found myself in a weird place with this series to start as I was doing basically a thought thread at like 3 a.m. because I couldn't sleep. And I was like, it's weird because I feel like individually, the Knicks, I don't think they have an individual defender as good as Drew Holiday. I don't think they have an individual defender as good as Giannis. I don't think they have an individual defender as good as Brook Lopez. Though I will note, Mitchell Robinson has been really freaking good defensively all year long. I think he deserves the love for that, what he's able to do in the regular season. And his series against Cleveland, I can't say enough good things about what Mitchell Robinson was able to do. But just in general, Jimmy is the weird blend of him facing like worse talent, but talent that's more equipped to deal with him. Just because of the size, like Josh Hart a little bit bigger. Quentin Grimes, though Jimmy found some comfort in the regular season series, like trying to post him up, like Grimes can hang with him. RJ's a strong dude. Josh Hart's a strong dude. And then with Mitchell Robinson kind of lurking around the paint, I don't think he's going to have as easy of a time as he did against Milwaukee, despite them having better personnel, in my opinion. And then you think about the way that Tibbs defends in general and his willingness to send help or to peel help in early. I don't think the same openings for Jimmy Butler is going to be there. So my initial thought bubble was like, what does this look like for Jimmy Butler? How much is he able to dictate versus New York trying to take things away from him schematically? And what does that open up on the back end? And how's Miami able to capitalize on that? That's where I started with this series. Like, what was your initial thought, question, scheme thing, et cetera?
My initial one was, who's going to adjust to this new series quicker? Both teams did very specific things or attacked very specific things to get to the next round. And each team presents a different challenge now. And who's going to figure it out? Because I think there's a lot of guys for the Knicks who could feel more free in this series. But they, you know, the Heat also throw a lot more at you. I think your Jimmy Butler point is sound. They have the activity. They also have the team defense. I think that's going to be different. Because they're going to pressure. But there's also going to be help points. They're going to send help. I really highly doubt Tibbs is going to let Jimmy Butler roam around with space like that. And if your key is just, hey, we just make Jimmy Butler uncomfortable and we live with the results, what does that do to Miami? What does that do to Jimmy Butler? I don't know if they go doubles to start, but is it going to be enough help to where things open up for Miami? Is Jimmy Butler going to be able to have the same success on drives and finishing against Mitchell Robinson? Can they open up drive and kick? Jimmy Butler against the person you don't want guarding Jimmy Butler is still one of Miami's best offensive things. So, hey, Jalen Brunson, come here. Let's see what that looks like. If he can get to Josh Hart, if he can get to Grimes, if he can get to Barrett, just like he did against Milwaukee and their wave of defenders, now what does it look like? So I think it's that. It's what are they trying to do? Can Miami make Jalen Brunson uncomfortable? Do they put Jimmy on him to start? Do they try and mix things up? Are they active in pick and roll and put two on the ball? We saw Jalen handle that against Cleveland, but does Miami do that? Do they try and throw some zone in there? Do they go drop? Like, there's different looks that they can throw at them. You know, is it switches against Bam? Like, how many different things can they toggle to maybe hit that? So I guess that's where my number one thing was, is how are these teams going to take these two guys that were very comfortable and won these series and try and bother the heck out of them? And I'm not exactly sure. Because on one hand, the Heat could have some of the same automatics, but it won't be to the same degree as Milwaukee. Like, I imagine Mitchell Robinson will be in a drop, but he's good at getting a little bit closer to the level. And so are those pull-ups going to be as clean? Are they going to be as comfortable with the looks they have? Are they going to try and drive and kick? What's the Kevin Love factor? Because Mitchell Robinson was great with early help, but he's going to have to defend someone. If it's Kevin Love, hey, I'm out here, man. This is me popping. If it's Bam, yeah, it's a little different on the short roll with me, man.
It's
a little different. I got this pull up, step back, spin. I got some things here. I have no disrespect, but I'm not Evan Mobley. So can they hit him? And now what does that look like? So that's probably where I first go.
I got you. I think on the Bam front, one, just to bounce to the Milwaukee closeout game, just a 20-point triple-double and stellar defense down the stretch against Giannis on a bad hamstring. That's just neat. The Bam thing is interesting because I think, one, it flows into who starts alongside Bam in the front court. It's a question that I had entering this one because I was in Miami early March when the Knicks came to town. And it was very early into the start Kevin Love portion of the program for Miami. And to say that New York hammered the automatic of Kevin Love at the level in that first quarter would be a drastic understatement. If you have league pass, go back and just watch the first quarter. And after the first 3 or 4 minutes where New York was like, oh, right, we are just going to empty this corner. We are going after Kevin Love. We're going to play out of that. And it was pull up after drawn foul, after drive, after pull up, after pull up, after drawn foul. And I'm just like, oh, they can't do this. On the flip side, though, New York is so good on the offensive glass. I don't know if they can afford to start Caleb Martin with Bam or start Duncan Robinson with Bam if they want to have extra spacing out there and they go with Max Strus. You remember early in the series against the Bucks, like it was Max Strus defending Brook Lopez on purpose. I don't think, you know, in terms of just the scoring, like maybe you can hang with that. Like Mitchell Robinson is not the interior threat as a scorer as someone like Brook Lopez is. Mitchell Robinson will hammer Miami on the offensive glass if they start too small. And so finding the balance between when we want to play Kevin Love, is he coming off the bench versus are we starting him, and how long the rope is going to be in his minutes, I think is going to be a very important game within the game in the series. Because I do think his spacing is going to be very important. Like the partnership with Jimmy Butler in particular is going to be very important. And if New York wants to go across matching at all, if they want to go like Julius Randle, which again, we got to keep an eye on what his health is. How is the ankle? Same thing with Quentin Grimes. Like, how healthy is Quentin Grimes going to be? Because he was the primary defender of Jimmy Butler in the regular season series. We didn't see him in the last two games of the first round series against Cleveland. So how healthy is he going to be? What's it going to look like? But beyond that, Kevin Love's very useful offensively. And when he's knocking down threes, like, that just opens up a whole nother area of space for those guys to attack, for Jimmy Butler to attack in particular. Can the Heat find the right blend with him? I think it's going to be very important.
Can I ask a supplemental question?
Sure.
One, do you have any Julius Randle thoughts? We are entering another Knicks preview, not knowing how Julius Randle's ankle feels. Hopefully he gets healthy. Do you have any thoughts on his impact on either end of the floor? Is this a tougher matchup for him on the offensive end? Is this an easier matchup for him defensively? Where do you land?
I think this is an easier matchup for him defensively. And I think it may wind up being a tougher matchup for him offensively. And I say, which sounds wild on the surface, considering, again, when I was in Miami for that game, I think that was the 43-point game that Julius Randle had. And he's just bombing away from three. So he very well could just knock down shots again and just throws whatever point I'm about to make over the top rope. But I say this because I think Miami can send help towards him if he gets going in a way that Cleveland didn't seem willing to do. And ultimately didn't matter because Julius didn't have it going after that first game or the first half of that first game. But I do think Miami can bother him a little bit more. And if you're going to start with two bigs, if Kevin Love gets that assignment, I think you feel okay with him dealing with the post-ups for Julius Randle, just from a strength perspective. If they cross-match, you have Randle on Mitchell Robinson, and you have Bam on Julius Randle. I think Miami will feel comfortable with that matchup, because even going back to that early matchup, Julius Randle made many a shots in Bam's face, but he made those shots in Bam's face. It wasn't necessarily Julius Randle just dominating Bam in that matchup physically or anything like that. So I do think that combined with the help that Miami can show and the different looks that they can show and just kind of testing out, hey, you handle double teams a whole lot better than you have in years past this year during the regular season. Let's see if you can do that now, though. Like, that's just an interesting thing to keep an eye on. And then defensively, I mean, a lot of it's going to be depending on who he's matched up with, I think. But I don't think Miami has the same pull-up threats that Cleveland does either, especially with Tyler Herro just not being there. And so you go to the first round matchup with Cleveland, and just about any pick and roll involving Julius Randle as a screen defender, he's up at the level to make sure, okay, Garland isn't going to get anything easy. Donovan Mitchell isn't going to get anything easy. I don't think he's going to have to play that aggressively. I think this can be more of a switch series for him. And when he's healthy and engaged, like, switching is his best and most comfortable scheme anyway. And so that's why I feel like he may have a little bit easier time defensively, but offensively it might get a little bit dicey. And if the ankle isn't right, and he isn't able to explode that way, then obviously that's going to complicate some things as well.
Got you. And to my second question, and what I will point out, just to give Kevin Love a little bit of bail, his coverage has shifted a little bit. It is no longer a trap or a hard show. It is, hey, I am right here at the level of the screen. I am going backwards. Please get back in front. All right, I'm out. And he nailed it against Milwaukee. Buddy, he nailed it. My next question was going to be, who is more important to their team in this series, RJ Barrett or Kyle Lowry?
Ooh, that's a good question. I think my immediate thought is Kyle Lowry, just because Miami needs the pull-ups. And just check out mutual friend of the program, Cooper Moorhead, his Twitter, as he pulled up some of the pull-up stats for Miami in that first round series against Milwaukee. And how they drastically outperformed what you would expect from their shooters in that series. But I think it's Kyle Lowry. Like, one, the pull-ups themselves are just going to have to fall if he does see drop. Even though, you know, to your earlier point, like, Mitchell Robinson is going to be in the drop. Brook Lopez is going to drop in round one. Mitchell Robinson plays it a lot higher than Brook Lopez does. So there will be an opening for the pull-up. It won't be the same opening. But Kyle Lowry's going to have to nail those if he gets them. Same thing for Gabe Vincent, but Kyle Lowry's definitely going to have to nail those. Also, he's just going to have to be willing to take those shots.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was weird in the back end of that series to where, like, you know, game three, game four, oh, hey, here's Kyle Lowry. Game five, he's, hey, man, you want to take a shot or what's happening here? Got a little iffy.
I asked that question because both of them can help. Kyle Lowry has to be willing to take the shot and look at the rim. And the RJ Barrett point, he was very good towards the end of that Cleveland series. Once he figured out his rhythm, he saw Caris LeVert was on him. He said, absolutely not. I'm going to make the right plays. Hey, man, fine. Whenever I get it, we're going to go to work. Miami has had a habit in the past with RJ Barrett of saying, hey, man, trap, 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 bud. And if they can now hit the RJ button and shift some of the lineups, I'm curious where that goes. I have a sneaky suspicion this is an Emmanuel Quickly series. I think he bounces back. I think he has liked to play against Miami. I think
his
defense has been well. I think he can hold up a little even more in this series. So I think he's going to have a good one. He's my X factor alongside Josh Hart. I think Josh Hart, his defense on Jimmy Butler is going to be key. And also, if he can hold up and close, that's big. I have Gabe Vincent for Miami as my X factor because they need his scoring and they need him to hold up against Jalen Brunson. And the defense against Jalen Brunson is really what I'm keeping an eye on. Who is going to stay in front of him? How are they going to attack the other people on the floor? Can Miami feel comfortable with multiple people guarding him? Who are your X factors?
Ooh, man. First, just to bounce off your Quickly point, he did shoot nearly 42% from three on over six attempts during the regular season series against Miami. And again, I was in the house for when he just lost his mind and was taunting the crowd as well during a pivotal fourth quarter against Miami in that one. So just to bounce off of that very quickly. As far as my X factors, though, on the Miami side, it's Kevin Love for me. I think they are going to need his combination of rebounding and general size and shooting and occasional playmaking as well. But it's all going to be dependent on how well he can hold up defensively. Can he do his job? If it's not just a flat-out hard show, to your point, if he's just at the level and dropping back, can he contain that initial drive and then drop back and give his guy time to get back? Because if you can do that and you can get him back closer to the rim, and now you have Bam and Kevin Love battling on the boards against Mitchell Robinson, that gives them a better chance to get that defensive rebound. That gives them a chance to get out and run. And you don't have to get into some of the, again, Miami's half-court offense was not great throughout the regular season. It's much better in that round one against Milwaukee, but there was a lot of tough shot making in that one. And so I think you want to avoid getting into this particular half-court battle against the Knicks because, again, their collective size in the front court, the willingness to show early help, the willingness to send extra help. We know what kind of guy Tibbs is defensively. Kevin Love's going to have to hold up and help him on the glass because if you can do that, Miami can space the floor a little bit better offensively, and I think it's going to help juice some things for him. On the Knicks front, it's Mitchell Robinson for me. I've been singing his praises all postseason long. Again, very good regular season as well. If this becomes the I am leaping at Jimmy Butler as he goes into his second fake and pivot, and now he has two fouls with 8:13 left in the first quarter, this can become a very different series if that becomes a consistent thing. And beyond that, I kind of teased up top, like New York can throw different bodies at Jimmy Butler. I will be surprised if we don't at least see a handful of possessions where Mitchell Robinson is the primary defender on Jimmy Butler, and we see the center on Jimmy Gambit. I was expecting to see more Giannis on Jimmy, I think just because of how, honestly, it felt like Drew did a good job in that first round series against Jimmy. Like, Jimmy just went crazy in that one. And then you factor in the injuries the back injury that Giannis was coming back from. Maybe they didn't want to give him that assignment. I would be shocked if we don't at least see a handful of that kind of cross-matching against Jimmy if he has it going with some of the post-ups and ISOs early. And if Mitchell Robinson does get that, again, he's going to have to be disciplined. He's going to have to maintain the discipline that he has showcased throughout the regular season and so far in the playoffs because that has been such a big area of growth for him this year, just being able to stay on the floor more. He can't revert in this series because it just erases all the progress that he made. And ultimately, it puts New York in a worse spot on both ends of the floor if he's not able to stay out there. Steve, actually a question first, and then we'll get into your prediction. You tossed out Jimmy Butler on Jalen Brunson. It's kind of a thing that Miami may be willing to do. What do you think the primary coverage on Jalen Brunson is going to be?
To start?
Yeah.
Could go one of two ways. They could say absolutely not and try and turn the heat up right from the jump. Or I would imagine maybe, I'm trying to think, maybe they go at the level, drop back a little bit. Like, hey, we're here, but we're not going to do that much. Neither would surprise me. That's why I'm kind of interested to see, okay, which way do they want to go to start? I don't, like, my gut says they don't want him to lead the dance to that degree. So we'll see, especially, and then I guess the matchups might tell it. Like, if Gabe Vincent's on Jalen Brunson, they may just be trapping and trusting, hey, Jimmy, Bam, y'all do the thing. But it, again, with K-Love, if he's going to be at the level again, then they may not want to do that.
I got you. I asked because much like the Bucks had like the ultimate battering ram in Giannis, but ultimately they didn't have a bunch of guys that, okay, we would just ISO and we would just let you drive and put a shoulder into the chest. The Knicks do. And so I kind of worry about it just being like a switch all and just kind of, okay, we're going to flatten your actions. We're going to go one-on-one there. And so that was interesting. I'm just trying to kind of piece through, like, how do they want to do this in this series? How do they want to take things away? And Jalen's also just very good at, okay, here's the hedge or here's the trap. I'll just string this out. Like, it doesn't feel like he turns the ball over a lot there. And so it's going to be very rotation dependent on Miami side. Like, can we contain this? Can we navigate this 4-on-3 on the back end? And then can we get back matched up once he turns it back into a 1-on-1? So I just wanted to get your thoughts on how they may go about that. Yeah, I guess beyond that, what is your prediction in this series?
Got to restore the feeling. I was 11, 12, 13. Heat, Knicks, whatever the series was, is going the distance. Didn't matter. So I'm going 7 games. The Miami Heat win.
Ooh. Okay. I am torn with this one because I feel like I am going to wind up repeating my mistake where it's like, hey, because in the Cavs series, like, man, if I knew Julius Randle was healthy, like, I'd probably lean here. And I said so on the Chase Down pod, but since I didn't know, I went with Cleveland. And sure enough, the Knicks just got them out the paint, figuratively and literally. And now we got another ankle thing with Julius Randle. And it seems a little worse at this point, especially with the short turnaround with how the series is going. I don't think Miami shoots like that in round one either. Like, this feels like a true pick'em. I think I lean Miami in 7 here. But I will once again acknowledge, like, I do think there's a bit of an interior advantage here for the Knicks. This may be a series where the bench can get a little bit looser. Man, this Knicks team is really good, man.
Clip that, Knicks fans. That man said that on the non-YouTube edition.
On the non-YouTube edition. Oh, brother. This is a really good time. I'll go Heat in 7. I don't feel great about it, though. I don't feel great about it. Let's get into some of the series that are still going on. Again, we're recording early on a Thursday, so the 6th game of Hawks-Celtics hasn't happened yet. The Hawks were able to extend this series without DeJounte Murray with a 119-117 victory, 38-13 for Trae Young, including a pull-up 3 from like 30 feet over Jaylen Brown, which had me yelling, like, what the heck is this? For me, it just kind of became a continuation of what I saw in like game 3 and 4, where it's like Trae Young is really starting to look comfortable out there, and he's really starting to dictate some things offensively. And that's not the place that Boston wants to be at with him. Even if they do still have like the best player in the series, I think Jason Tatum's still the best player in the series. I do think they have the better team overall. They should win this series in 6 or 7. But Trae Young is starting to dictate a lot. And I go back through like some of the pick and roll stats with Trae Young. The first 2 games of the series, a possession featuring a Trae Young pick and roll was at 0.8 points per possession, which awful mark. And you think about what Trae Young did in the regular season, that was at 1.01 points per possession, which was 26th among 55 players with at least 1,000 reps in pick and roll during the regular season. So to go from 1.01 points per possession to 0.8 is a drastic drop. And then over the last three games of the series is up to 1.09 points per possession, which basically would have ranked fourth in the NBA among high volume pick and roll pairing. So basically, first two games of the series, Trae Young pick and roll was less efficient than a Jaden Ivey pick and roll in Detroit. He was the worst person on this list. And over the last three games, he's basically at Kyrie, Donovan Mitchell, De'Aaron Fox level during the regular season, just to kind of contextualize how wild the split has been. It has gone from, okay, if Robert Williams is in this action, I'm getting drop. I'm getting to a pull-up or a floater of some sort. If it's Al Horford, I'm mostly going to get a drop here. I'm getting to a pull-up or a floater. And if he switches out, I know how I want to attack him one-on-one. And it was telling to me that towards the end of that game five, Boston would switch Al Horford and it's like, wait, nope, actually, Marcus Smart, get back over here. We are trying to get the ball out of this man's hands. That it's gone from, that is progressively gone from, we are defending this action two-on-two, we don't think Trae can beat us enough, to we are now starting to send some extra stuff, is interesting to me. In addition to Trae now looking at, okay, well, if y'all are switching across the perimeter, let me get Jaylen Brown in this action and then go into a pick and roll to see what we can do here. I don't really want to deal with Derek White. I don't really want to deal with Marcus Smart. I can manipulate things how I want to. I am worried about Boston letting Trae get that comfortable in this series.
Well, you nailed it on the head. And this is why, you know, I leaned in a little too long with the East play-in, because these teams are annoying. You don't want to deal with Trae Young in a playoff series. And he displayed exactly why you don't want to. He decided to lead the dance. Hey, man, cool drop. Here's a pull-up. Here's a floater. Cool switch. I like the Horford matchup. I can drive or get to my step back. I'm hunting my step back. Hey, Robert Williams, come here. Pull up. So he felt comfortable. Boston started to mix in the switch and double. I anticipate, and of course, the next time you'll hear from us after this, all the first round will be complete, but I anticipate Boston saying, not you. They started to tap into the switch and double a little bit towards the end of the fourth. Trae didn't really cooperate with most of it, mm-hmm. but I imagine they're not going to let him be as comfortable and lead the dance to that same degree. And they need to. Boston has to do whatever they can to finish this thing off. You do not want to go to a game seven with Trae Young. And the issue for Atlanta is not, it's not even really scoring in this one. I think we all knew they could score. The question was, would it matter? And I think we've seen, oh, it can. And if Boston's going to play around with their food and not lock in defensively,
their
and
food,
then offensive. Their food. I said food.
Yeah, just one. Yeah.
No doc around here, bud. And then offensively, not execute, not have the movement, not put pressure on the Hawks. And give the Hawks credit. They battled in that fourth. I know everyone wanted to throw Joe Mazzulla and company over the top rope. But it was a scenario where Boston was like, hey, let's attack Trae Young for seven straight minutes. And Trae was like, hey, let's not.
Hey, I doubt it.
That man was scram squitching. Man, so can they hit the right buttons? Do they have the right mindset defensively? Do it take them away? Do they move the ball offensively? Is this series over? That's pretty much it for me. If this goes to a seventh game, it is a coin flip, and a coin flip featuring Trae Young does not sound fun.
Does not sound fun at all, especially with DeJounte Murray, I guess, sans another like ref bump. He would also be available for this game seven as well. You give this Atlanta group confidence heading into a game seven. That gets dicey. That gets dicey indeed. It would behoove Boston to take care of business. If not this Thursday night, really lock in that game seven if we get it. Buddy, Trae Young will not be afraid of the moment. That doesn't mean he's going to shoot 80% from the field if they get a game seven, but you're not going to rattle him in a game seven. You don't want to play around like that.
Nah, Boston's just got to be more locked in. More drives, more tempo, more movement, better defense. And again, there were seven times in that game that they could have slammed the door. Mm-hmm. They just didn't. So we'll see. We'll see if they're able to get that done or if Trae Young is able to turn things around.
Got you. One quick question before we move to the next game. With the game six or the game seven, do you anticipate Joe Mazzulla going to more Malcolm Brogdon down the stretch over Marcus Smart if he feels like things are kind of stalling out like it did in that fourth quarter in game five? Or
no.
Okay.
I don't, because of defense.
Okay. Makes sense.
Don't, like, it's not even Malcolm Brogdon's fault. I think it's just philosophy.
Okay. No, that makes sense. I just want to see where you landed on that. The Grizzlies were able to keep their season alive with a 116-99 victory. hilarious game to go back through because it was just a battle of which half court offense would do enough. And both of these half court offenses were bad. An 85.6 offense rating in the half court for Memphis, which again, laugh worthy, bad. What is this? Blue with the percentile thing if you have a clean the glass subscription. And then you look at the Lakers numbers and it's 68.8. And it's like, how do you do that? You could literally just chuck shots from half court and end up with something higher than that, you would imagine. It's been a chore watching these two teams battle in the half court. But at any rate, the third
quarter. Well, yeah, because they're battling themselves as well as the defense. It's like a handicap match. Continue.
No, that was just funny. And then with actual hilarity as I went back through that game, because that was something that we were checking in on during the watch party that we hosted, but it wasn't a primary game for us. LeBron got a layup with 6:49 left in the third quarter, and it was 68-67 Memphis, and then Memphis outscored them 24-9 to close things out in that quarter. And I was like, oh, well, they found enough. They forced enough misses for the Lakers. It was funny because, like, I think the Lakers either committed one turnover or zero turnovers during that stretch. It was just we miss, they get bored, they push, or they operate an early offense, and then they make threes. They went 4-6-3 in that stretch. And I was like, well, there's your game, because you sure aren't getting anything against the set defense right now. And it just kind of snowballed from there. So that was fun. So for me, it was kind of the half-court offense just looked kind of wonky to me overall. But was there anything that stood out to you that kind of popped for either side in this one?
I think these two teams bring out the worst in each other at this point, having seen five games of this so far. And with this reaching its climax, both of these teams turn defense into offense. Both of these teams lose their way in the half court offensively. So what's the path? What's the win? How do they get it done? For the Lakers, can they just find a way to win one more? Because it feels like all they need to do is, hey, Memphis, you just stay in the mud with us. We get to the fourth, we figure it out, we go, we advance. I don't necessarily know if there's one specific thing. The Lakers' ball movement, their tempo has to be better. They got to put pressure on Memphis. They got to use AD and LeBron as an advantage and try and create some openings that way. If you're not going to move the ball from side to side, at least put your pressure points in action. Get your lineups right. Don't let the small lineup get dinged. Like, they just have to hit the notes. For Memphis, if they are able to execute, and we've seen if they get stops and they're able to run, it opens things up. The question is, have they found enough to get this done? Because Desmond Bane, a.k.a. Desmond Maine,
there it is
cooking. And the most interesting part of Game 5 was watching the Lakers be like, all right, man, you got to stop.
We are putting two on the ball, bud.
Two on the ball against Desmond. And the reason why that's huge, and Memphis didn't necessarily score every single time. They got good looks. Mm-hmm. But if you're putting two on the ball, that opens up ball movement, rolling, Lakers having to rotate. And I'm very curious to see, do the Lakers try and turn his water off and say, no, we're going two on the ball? Will they save it in their back pocket? Because two on the ball says, hey, you're not doing anything. We're going to trust that these other guys beat us. But if Memphis is able to get to that blend, it gets really tricky. Ja has felt comfortable these last two games. Mm-hmm. You can see him hitting poetry in motion, hitting whisper in the wind, hitting him with the twist of fate. Ja Hardy's here. So if they have Desmond going, if they have Ja going, if there's more usage for Jaren Jackson Jr., more movement for him off screens, getting him downhill, getting some switches he likes, it gets tricky. And so again, it is on the Lakers to go ahead and send a message in this game six. I don't think you want to make that flight back to Memphis.
You don't want that. Slim and Huskies is good. It ain't that good.
You don't want to make that flight back to the grindhouse with all those towels. That's another team that needs to go ahead and if they can, try and take care of business. Now, Memphis has no margin for error. So they can't play around. If they have one bad half-court game, all of this could be nonsense. So I'm fascinated to see if the Lakers can just cross the finish line, because that's the beauty of the playoffs. Yep, you got a lead, but you have to continue to do it.
Mm-hmm. Got to cross that line. I'll just say, like, I had the question as I was going back through that game. It's like, huh, they're putting two on the ball against Desmond Bane. Do they need to do that? And I guess moving forward, like, will they feel the need to continue to do that? Because, like, with how wonky Memphis's half-court offense has been throughout this series, I understood, like, Desmond did shoot well. He did play well in that game. So it's not like I didn't literally get it. But it was just like, man, do you want to feed automatics to a team that has struggled to score against you? Especially when you already have the lead. It's like, can you, to your point that you always rail against, like, can you live with some of these versus sending the extra attention to making it easier? And now someone else gets a rhythm. And now that carries into game six and game seven, whatever the case may be there. So, like, that was kind of a thought for me. And it feels like I'm just kind of beating the horse at this point. But, like, keeping an eye on how aggressive LeBron James is, what the paint presence is for him, 12 drives, 45 minutes in that overtime game. You get to the last one, 5 drives total, played 36 minutes. A lot of threes, not many free throw attempts, did not log a post up in this game. Keeping an eye on the usage, keeping an eye on the aggression, and seeing how Memphis deals with that and see if they're able to play out of that. You know, to your point, can they use LeBron as that pressure point to open things up and make life a little bit easier for them in the half court? What does that look like? That's kind of what I'm keyed in on heading into the next couple of games, if a couple of games are necessary there. And now we close with the Warriors and the Kings. The Warriors with a 123-116 victory to take a 3-2 series lead. I guess I forgot to say with the other series, the Lakers still lead 3-2 there. But 3-2 lead for the Warriors now heading into this one. 31-8 for Steph Curry. Just a masterclass off the bench again for Draymond Green. Quick question before we get into like actual analysis or just thoughts moving forward in this series. Am I just tripping for still feeling like Draymond Green's the second best player on this team?
I mean, it still feels like Clay slander, so yes.
I don't think it's slander. Like, I just think Draymond is very important to what they do on both sides.
I think he's the second most important player on this team. Mm-hmm. I will hand you that, but also.
Okay. I asked if I was tripping. The answer was a, you know, yes. With
Just a little bit. All right.
That's fine. I respect your opinion. That's why I asked. That's fine. Okay.
You want some water? Hey.
You know what? I ain't doing this with you. I will pass the baton to you shortly, but like Draymond popped for me on both ends of the floor. And I think within that realm, one, Draymond came off the bench again. And I think what that did, at least like conceptually, just a bunch of one big lineups, which means more spacing on the floor for Golden State, which equals more strain for Sacramento to have to deal with. If you botch a switch or if they involve Sabonis in something and it's two to the ball and he holds a beat too long, that is a slip. That is a slip. That is a pass. That is a cut from the corner. That is a 2v1. And that is not what you want to give Golden State. Or even if they're going into some of their action above the break, if someone, there was an early bucket for Klay Thompson to where it looks like he's lifting up. He just back cuts Kevin Herter, gets an easy one down low. It's like, well, now there's even more room. Because it's not like they're doing something with Looney, but Dre's on the floor, so you can at least pretend to stunt somewhere and then kind of rotate behind that. Now it's just Jordan Poole in the lineup for you. And then for you to get good stuff, and here I just sing the praise of Kevon Looney, who's just been tremendous over the last few games. You get good stuff offensively and you're able to hold up enough defensively with the starting unit. And now you transition into Draymond at the five and all the advantages that come with that. I just like the blend that Golden State's able, that they're starting to find. And Sacramento's still competing. I still think, like, you zoom out, overall, they've done a good job defensively in the series. It just feels like the Warriors are starting to ding them just enough. And now it's game six coming back home for them. And that's a bit worrisome for me. What stood out to you in that game five, and what are you kind of looking at heading into game six?
I think the larger thing for me is just the ways that Golden State continues to pick at and ding the Kings over the course of this series. And now you wonder, and I kind of tried to ask this earlier as this was rumbling, have the Warriors done enough? Have they found that blend to get out of this series? When you think of it in totality, just the tactics wearing on Sacramento. Like Sacramento is competing. Sacramento is still scoring. It's not as fluid as they are used to. It's not necessarily the same type of things that they're doing. You know, you look up, you're seeing Harrison Barnes post-ups. And it's like, I mean, yes, but this you? How much are you wearing on Sabonis? And the impact of basically saying, hey, Kevon Looney is going to stay back there. All these handoffs and movement, we are going to take this forearm, put it in your chest, and go over the top. You want to come back door? Guess what, pal? Kevon Looney's right there.
Guess who's here?
Hey, Sabonis, it's great watching you in the regular season hurt people with the handoffs and then mix in the elbow flash and drive. Here's all this space. Kevon Looney's right there. Hey, De'Aaron Fox, you're a great player. You are cooking. Here's this space. Here are these unders. Here are some of these switches. Here are these wings. Go get these buckets, man. Kevin Herter, not a lot of space for you. Not too much for you.
It's been such a quiet and Herter series, man.
Hey, Keegan Murray, go ahead. Malik Monk, sure, man.
Sure, just man.
Don't what you did in the first two, but hey, cool. And that's where it gets tough. And they're slowly feels like they're taking things off the King's menu, or at least making it difficult to cook. Mm-hmm. And on the other end, they just keep finding things. It was like, I thought they were going to have to smash the Stephen Curry pick and roll button. They've used it, but they haven't had to smash it. Being in that scenario, going into an elimination game is not ideal because they can just do it. They just be like, hey, this is going to be the game where Draymond plays a whole bunch of minutes at the five and he just rolls a whole bunch. And now what are you going to do? They keep finding ways to get the Kings in rotation. They keep finding ways to open things up. Klay Thompson, big game in game five, but he's now getting two on the ball to some degree.
Yes.
If he's coming off a screen, he's now able to get a pick and roll in a possession and at least hold the defense to open something up. That's the concern. The amount of ways that Golden State is getting Sacramento in rotation, Draymond on the short roll, Kevon Looney on the short roll, Wiggins cutting, like they just feel very comfortable on that end of the floor. Mm-hmm. And that's where it's like, do they have enough? They're blending in small lineups. Kevon Looney's been great. Can Sacramento ding them enough? It's going to be a fight. And Golden State's going to finish it off. It's going to be a fight. I mean, you got game six Klay. You got Draymond. Draymond really did the stomp and then dropped 20 plus. Can we talk about that for a second?
I mean, that's respectfully messy indeed. That's just tough.
And, you know, this doesn't feel like an indictment on the Kings. It's a difficult matchup. Mm-hmm. These are the defending champions.
Yeah, they just won last year. Yeah, they still got the important people. So.
Yeah, it's going to be on Sacramento to find a way to get their defense in a better place and then offensively feel better about the shots they're creating. And I think they can do that. It's still plenty of fight left.
There you go. There you go.
But it's Golden State.
Yeah, they're tough.
Handing them that opportunity.
It's good, got a tie. Three quick things, and then we can begin to close at the very least. On the handoff point, during the regular season, no team ran more handoffs than the Sacramento Kings did. In terms of efficiency, 1.05 points per possession on trips featuring a handoff for the Kings. That was second best in the NBA during the regular season. That is down to 0.952 points per possession in the postseason. The Warriors have done a great job of taking that off the menu. Second thing, it's kind of funny that like one of the questions that I had entering the series, like, hey, how often can Golden State go small? And now they just have two separate small lineups. Like, okay, here's Looney. And now we're going to transition into Draymond. So this is why I am using the microphone. Steve Kerr is on the sideline. Very smart man. So that's funny. And then beyond that, just continuing to keep an eye on how many jumpers De'Aaron Fox is taking in this series. It's one, to just hope he's okay. Like the fact that he was able to score as well as he did with the finger issues that he's dealing with is impressive. But beyond that, it's just continued to feel like the shot profile just keeps moving further and further and further out. And I think that kind of plays into what Golden State wants defensively. So just a quick note on that. Rapid fire, since we did have some series end. The Bucks are done. The Clippers are done. The Cavs are done. The Wolves are done. We can start with the Bucks, since they were the most recent team to head out of here. Where do they go from here? You have Chris Middleton with a player option. Javon Carter with a player option, though that's around the minimum. Brook Lopez is a free agent. Is this just a bring the band back together? Are there any tweaks that you would like to see them make conceptually? You don't have to name a name or anything. How do you feel about Mike Budenholzer at this point? Where do you think Milwaukee goes heading into this offseason?
It's going to be hard to not bring the band back together. At the very least, you need to at least bring that back and then see what you can do from there. I mean, I thought they did a lot of retooling. I thought they had a lot of people that worked out. The funny part is they didn't use a lot of those lineups or a lot of that personnel. So that's not ideal. So I think it's just going to have to be making sure they have the flexibility they need lineup-wise and scheme-wise, and then having more purpose in the half court offensively. Go to Amazon, buy some seasoning.
Go to, well, we have the podcast title, huh? Yeah, it's just you can't give up 5 seconds for Jay Crowder and then just not have him in the rotation. He wasn't going to be a rotation player for you. Like, that's just something that just has not aged well. I made the joke on Twitter, like, UD ended up with more time on the court than Jay Crowder when UD got into the shouting match with Bobby Portis and got teed up. Like, that was just, that's just kind of tough. That's just kind
of. Hey, Bossman 99, that is Nekias Duncan. N-E-K.
This what we on? All right. How you been doing the pod for how long? Anyway, Cavs are out of here. Caris LeVert's an unrestricted free agent, as is Danny Green, Raul Neto, Robin Lopez, all unrestricted free agents. For Cleveland, is this just, we got some data collected, now we know where to move from here, or do you see the need for them to make more structural changes moving forward?
No. Okay. They understood what the thing was. This is part of the progress. This is year two of this. And they went to the playoffs. It didn't go so well. And now they know what they need. They know they need better wings. They know they need better depth on the bench. And Evan Mobley and Jared Allen know they need to get better. And hopefully Darius Garland got a taste of the playoffs. He knows what he needs to work on. Donovan Mitchell, he knows the pull-ups have to get going. And those two are going to have to defend in the playoffs. It's just, those are just facts of life.
Yeah.
Garland and Mitchell are going to have to defend in the playoffs. Evan Mobley is going to have to make defenses pay. They're going to have to find someone else who can either make shots or initiate offense for them as the fifth. And Jared Allen's got to produce better on both ends. Point blank. They faced the matchup that dared them to win, and they didn't win.
Yeah.
Like, I'm just not down with the whole J.B. Bickerstaff did a terrible job. He didn't make any adjustments. Go watch the series. He tried a whole bunch of stuff.
We saw Lamar Stevens in game 5.
He tried a whole lot of different actions, empty corner, pick and roll. The Knicks said, hey, your movement? Nope, we're taking it away. Garland? Nope, we're keeping you out of rhythm. Donovan Mitchell, here's some doubles. Evan Mobley, Jared Allen beat us.
It's just like, oh, you have to, guess we got to knock those shots, huh? I got you. I guess secondary, like, this is year two of this. I agree with you, to be clear, before I ask this question. Like, I do think this is very much, okay, we see where the growth needs to be made. They absolutely need to add some wing depth, some reliable wing depth if they can. That's very clear. How much rope do you give the Allen Mobley pairing moving forward? Do you give them another 2 years, 3 years? Or how quickly are you willing to pivot on that? If we hit the postseason next year and it's similar spacing issues or something like that.
I think definitely at least one more year.
Okay.
Gotcha. Like if it's rinse repeat with Jared Allen, then I could see a change.
Got you. All right. To Denver, Minnesota. Minnesota obviously out of here. Some interesting Chris Finch quotes to come out after that game. He said, the most important thing is that we have a big enough body of work. I think we can properly evaluate it. I still remain extremely confident we're able to maximize those guys in regards to Rudy Gobert and Karl Anthony Towns together. And Finch on the offense specifically, I've got to do a better job of trying to figure out an offense that works around these guys a little bit more effortlessly.
Yeah, sounds like a person who likes his job, and B, yeah, you do. I mean, they're all in on Rudy and Kat. And so I think you found more of what you could get from Rudy once you got Mike Conley on the floor. They got to throw him the ball. The issue with Cat is, again, what are you going to do when he's at the four? Is he just going to be spaced? Can you open up different looks for him? Can you build something that benefits both of them when they're on the floor at the same time? Or is it just going to be Rudy do pick and roll stuff? Can you punish switches? Can Anthony Edwards handle two on the ball? Like, I think they got to a nice blend of playmaking towards the end of the season, but they have to answer those questions. They're going to have to understand how to get those guys going and avoid. And it's a dual thing. They got to figure it out in the regular season. But in the playoffs, you have to do something to make me not go into this coaches meeting and say, switch against Rudy, switch against Cat, we'll live.
That's fair. That's fair. And just on the free agency front for them, Naz Reid can hit the market. That looks like that can be a big one, figuratively and literally. Jalen Noel, also unrestricted. Austin Rivers, unrestricted. Nikhil Alexander-Walker, who ended up starting multiple games in this series, got Jamal Murray assignment, knocked down some crucial shots as well. He is a restricted free agent, so they can bring him back if they would like. Lastly, the Los Angeles Clippers. Russell Westbrook can hit the market. Mason Plumlee can hit the market. Just judging by the comments from Lawrence Frank earlier today, again, recording early on a Thursday, they look like they want to bring Russ back. I'm curious to see what the price point on that is going to be and how they're able to figure that out, but at least they seem to want him back. What, if any, changes would you like to see from the Clippers beyond that? Or is it just we need Kawhi and Paul George healthy?
It's health for me.
Gotcha.
I still think they have a formula. I think they have, I think they have that blend of guards and wings that they like. I think they show what they can do when they have two bigs and they don't have to go small. It's Kawhi and PG for me.
Gotcha.
It's health.
I got you. I think for them as well, especially when you factor in they're trying to move into the new building, I think 2 years from now at this point, like it would be nice if they have both of their stars locked in. I think they can both decline their player option to hit the market next offseason if they like. So extension talks, I'm sure. We'll get some kind of reports from Woj or Shams or something like that to see just where that's leaning as we hit the summer and stuff. But for me, it's definitely going to be to help. I do understand the logic of, hey, let's at least hear what the calls are, even if we decide to keep these two. But ultimately, I think the Clippers' best chance is going to be winning with the two stars that they have. We saw what Kawhi Leonard looked like at the beginning of that series against Phoenix when he was, I guess, healthy-ish in game one and just wasn't very healthy in game two and still dominated. So hopefully that they're just able to stay on the court. And this looks a little bit different from them. I do wonder what the conversation is going to be like next offseason if they're not able to make a deep run and where they kind of go from there. I think that gets interesting in regards to what they gave up to bring those two in. It's been, they've peaked at the conference finals at this point. So that's going to be something to keep an eye on. But I understand, give another run at it. I think Russ was very good with the Clippers this year, which, what do you know? Different context, it ended up looking a little bit better, but. Excited to see what this team looks like next season. And with that, I would like to say thank you for listening to this episode of The Dunker Spot. If you have not already, please subscribe to us. We are on Apple, Spotify, Google, Stitcher, Podbean, wherever you get your podcasts, you can find us. You can follow me on Twitter at NikiasNBA. You can follow Steve on Twitter at SteveJones20. Join the Dunker Spot community on Twitter. We are having fun discussions in there. Join our Dunker Spot online watch parties via Watch Playback. You get live analysis from us. You get live antics from the chat. We have a lot of fun in there. We're going live virtually every day for playoff games. And as we get into these conference semis, we're definitely going to be locked in on those. So if you want to watch games with us, pick our brains live, come rock with us. The link will be in the description of the podcast. It should be hyperlinked. So if so, just click on that, sign up. It's free, no shenanigans. If not, just copy the link, paste it into your browser. Again, sign up. It's free, no shenanigans. Come rock with us. Subscribe to JJ Redick's YouTube channel. Our next episode, so I guess the Monday or Tuesday drop, that will be on his YouTube channel if you want to watch the podcast and listen that way. So subscribe to that as well. And with that, we will catch y'all next week.
The real failure was not taking a nap at 2 p.m.